Chapter 45. No one gave Stacy, Mancuso, and Weatherhill a second look as they penetrated the depths of Edo City with relative ease and precision. The Hollywood makeup expert, Jordan Flew to Tokyo, did a masterful job of applying false folds to their eyes, realigning and darkening the eyebrows, and designing wigs of luxuriant, thick black hair. Mancuso, because he spoke flawless Japanese, was dressed in a business suit and acted as boss to Stacy and Weatherhill, who wore the yellow jumpsuits of Suma's engineering inspection teams. Using data from Jim Hanamura's report on the security procedures, along with identification cards and passcodes provided by a British deep-cover operative working in cooperation with Jordan, they smoothly passed through the checkpoints and finally reached the entrance to the tunnel. This was the tricky part of the operation. The human security guards and identity detection machines had not proven difficult to deceive. But according to Penner, during their final briefing, the final barrier would be the toughest test. A robotic sensory security system met them as they entered a totally featureless, glaringly lit, white-painted room. The floor was empty of all furniture, and the walls barren of signs or pictures. The door they entered from seemed to be the only entrance and exit. "State your business," the robot demanded in mechanical Japanese. Mancuso hesitated. He was told to expect robot sentry machines, but not something that looked like a trash can on wheels that spouted orders. "Fiber optic communication section to modify and inspect system," he complied, trying to hide his awkwardness at interacting with artificial intelligence. "Your job order and passcode. Emergency order 46R for communications inspection and test program." Then he brought his open hands together, touching the fingertips slightly, and repeated the word Shaw 3 times. Mancuso could only hope the British operative had supplied them with the correct pass sign and code word, and had programmed their genetic codes into the robotic security memories. "In sequence, press your right hands against my sensing screen," ordered the RoboGuard. All three dutifully took turns placing their hands on a small blinking blue screen recessed in the barrel-round chest. The robot stood mute for a few moments, processing the data from its computer and comparing facial features and body size against the names and description in its memory disks. A remarkable advance, thought Weatherhill. He'd never seen a computer that could put into memory the data fed to it by a television camera and process the images in real time. They stood composed and businesslike, knowing from their briefing the robot was programmed to spot the slightest measure of nervousness. They also kept their eyes trained on him. Wandering, avoiding eyes would have invited suspicion. Weatherhill managed a bored yawn while their genetic codes and finger and handprints were matched up. "Clearance confirmed," the RoboGuard said at last. Then the entire wall at the opposite end of the barren room swung inward and he rolled aside. "You may enter. If you remain beyond 12 hours, you must notify Security Force Number 6. The British operative had come through. They had passed the obstacle with flying colors. They walked through the door into a carpeted passageway that led to the main tunnel. They exited onto a boarding platform as a buzzer sounded and red and white strobe lights flashed. A work train loaded with construction materials was pulling away from an expansive underground rail yard, with the tracks converging at the main tunnel entrance that Mancuso judged was 4 meters in diameter. After 3 eerie minutes of complete silence, an aluminum car with a glass bubble top that could seat 10 people approached the platform on a single rail. The interior was empty, the controls unmanned. A door slid open with a slight hiss, and they entered. "A maglev," Weatherhill said quietly.
"A what?"
Stacy asked. "Maglev for magnetic levitation. It's the concept based on the repulsion and attraction between two magnets. The interaction between powerful magnets mounted under the train with others lining a single rail raised in the center moves the cars on a field of electromagnetism. That's why it's usually referred to as a floating train." "The Japs have developed the most advanced system in the world," Mancuso added. "Once they mastered the cooling of the onboard electromagnetic superconductors, they had a vehicle that literally flies inches above its track at aircraft speeds." The doors closed and the little car paused as its computerized sensors waited for the all-clear ahead. A green light blinked on above the track and they glided into the main tube soundlessly, picking up speed until the sodium vapor lamps embedded in the roof of the tunnel merged into an eye-dazzling yellow blur.
"How fast are we going?" Stacy wondered.
"A wild guess would be 320 kilometers an hour, Weatherhill replied.
Mancuso nodded. At this rate, the trip should only take about 5 minutes. It seemed the floating train had no sooner reached its cruising speed than it began to slow. With the smoothness of a skyscraper elevator, it slid to a quiet stop. They stepped out onto another deserted platform. Once they were clear, the car came about on a turntable, aligned itself on the opposite rail, and accelerated back to Edo City. "The end of the line," Mancuso said softly. He turned and led the way through the only door on the platform. It opened into another carpeted passageway that stretched 30 meters before ending at an elevator. Inside, Weatherhill nodded at the Arabic numerals on the control buttons. "Up or down?"
"How many floors and which one are we on?" inquired Stacy.
12. We're on 2.
"Hanamura's sketches only indicated 4, said Mancuso.
"They must have been preliminary drawings that were altered later."
Stacy stared at the lighted panel pensively.
"So much for the hub-and-spoke layout."
"Without exact directions to the computerized electronics section," said Weatherhill, "we'll have to scratch our original plan and go for the power-generating station."
"If we can find it before arousing suspicion," complained Mancuso.
"It's all we've got going. Tracing electrical wiring to the source will take less time than trying to stumble under the control center."
12 floors of rooms and passageways," murmured Stacy uneasily. "We could wander around lost for hours."
"We're here and we have no alternatives," said Mancuso, glancing at his watch. "If Pitt and Giordino were successful in landing on the island's surface and diverting Suma's security systems, we should have time enough to plant the plastic and escape back through the tunnel to Edo City." Weatherhill looked at Stacy and Mancuso, then looked at the elevator panel. He knew exactly how they felt. Nerves tense, minds alert, their bodies honed and ready to act. They had come this far, and now it all depended on their decisions in the next few minutes. He punched the button marked 6.
"Might as well try the middle floor," he said, with practical logic.
Mancuso raised the briefcase that camouflaged 2 automatic weapons and clutched it under his arm. Immobile, he and Stacy and Weatherhill stood quietly in uneasy apprehension. A few seconds later, there was an audible bong. The digital light for the 6th floor flashed, and the doors spread apart. Mancuso went through with Stacy and Weatherhill at his heels. When he stopped dead after 2 steps, he hardly felt the others bump into him. They all stood and stared like village idiots on a space journey to Mars. Everywhere inside a vast, domed gallery, there was a bustling, purposeful confusion one would expect from an army of efficient assembly line workers, except there were no spoken orders or shouts or group conversations. All of the specialists, technicians, and engineers working on a great semicircle of computers and instrument consoles were robots in myriad different sizes and shapes. They'd struck gold on the first try. Weatherhill had unwittingly pushed the floor button that took them directly to the electronic brains of Suma's nuclear command center. There were no human helpers anywhere in the complex. The entire workforce was totally automated and made up of sophisticated high-tech machines that worked 24 hours a day without coffee breaks, lunch, or sick leave, an operation inconceivable to an American union leader. Most rolled on wheels, some on tractor treads. Some had as many as 7 articulated arms, sprouting like octopus tentacles from wheeled carts. A few could have passed as the familiar multipurpose units found in a dentist's office. But none walked on legs and feet or remotely resembled C-3PO from Star Wars or Robbie from Forbidden Planet. The robots were immersed in their individual work programs and went about their business without taking notice of the human intruders.
"Do you get the feeling we've become obsolete?" whispered Stacy.
"Not good," said Mancuso. "We'd better get back inside the elevator."
Weatherhill shook his head.
"Not a chance. This is the complex we came to destroy. These things don't even know we're here. They're not programmed to interfere with humans. And there are no robotic security guards around. Pitt and Giordino must have saved our ass by distracting them. I say we send this automated anthill to the moon."
"The elevator has moved on," said Stacy, pressing the down button. "For the next minute, we've got nowhere else to go."
Mancuso wasted no more time in discussion. He set the briefcase on the floor and began tearing the packets of C-8 plastic explosives attached by tape from around his lower legs. The rest did the same from under their jumpsuit uniforms. "Stacy, the computer section. Tim, the nuclear bomb prime systems. I'll tackle the communications gear." They had moved less than 5 steps toward their given targets when a voice boomed and echoed through the concrete walls of the chamber.
"Remain where you are. Do not move, or you will surely die."
perfect English with barely a trace of a Japanese accent and the voice cold, menacing. The surprise was complete, but Mancuso bluffed it out, trying to find a target for the automatic weapons inside his briefcase. "We are test engineers on an inspection and test program. Do you wish to see and hear our passcode?" All human engineers and inspectors, along with their codes, were discontinued when the fully autonomous vehicles could perform their programs without intervention and human supervision, the disembodied voice rumbled. "We were not aware of the change. We were instructed by our superior to inspect the fiber-optic communications," Mancuso persisted, as his hand pressed a button disguised as a cleat on the bottom of his briefcase. And then the elevator door opened, and Roy Orita stepped out onto the control center floor. He paused for a moment, his eyes staring with a certain respect at his former mate team members. "Spare the bravado," he said with a triumphant smile. "You failed. Your covert operation to stop the Kaiten project has failed totally and absolutely. And you're all going to die for it." Jordan and Sandecker shared a light breakfast with the president at the executive retreat at Camp David. They sat at a table in a small cottage in front of a crackling hickory log fire. Jordan and the admiral found the room uncomfortably warm, but the president seemed to enjoy the heat, sipping a cup of southern chicory-flavored coffee while wearing an Irish wool-knit sweater. The president's special assistant, Dale Nichols, came in from the kitchen with a glass of milk. "Don Kern is outside," he reported, addressing Jordan. "I believe he has an update on Soseki Island," said Jordan. The president gestured at Nichols. "By all means, send him in. And as an afterthought, get him a cup of coffee and see if he'd like anything to eat." Kern only accepted the coffee and took a seat on a nearby sofa. The president stared expectantly at him, but Jordan gazed emptily into the fire. "They're in," Kern announced. "They're in," echoed the president. "Every one of them?" Kern nodded. "All three." "Any problems?" asked Jordan. "We don't know. Before our British contact signal was mysteriously cut off, he said they'd made it safely through the tunnel." The president reached out and shook Jordan's hand. "Congratulations, Ray." "A bit premature, Mr. President," said Jordan. "They still have hurdles to clear. Penetrating the Dragon Center is only the first step in the plan." "What about my men?" demanded Sandecker testily. "They signaled a safe landing," answered Kern. "We have no reason to believe they were injured or harmed by Suma's security guards." "So where do we go from here?" inquired the president. "After placing their explosives and putting the Dragon Center temporarily out of commission, our people will attempt to effect a rescue of Congresswoman Smith and Senator Diaz. If all goes according to plan, we'll have breathing space to nail Hideki Suma to the nearest cross and send in our military for a wholesale destruction operation." The president's face took on a concerned look. "Is it possible for two men and a woman to accomplish all that in the next 36 hours? Jordan smiled tiredly. "Trust me, Mr. President, my people can walk through walls." "And Pitt and Giardino," Sandecker pressured Kern. "Once our people signal they're ready, a submarine will surface and launch a Delta One team to evacuate them from the island. Pitt and Giardino will be brought out, too." "Seems to me you're taking an awful lot for granted," said Sandecker. Kern gave the admiral a confident smile. "We've analyzed and fine-tuned every phase of the operation until we're certain it has a 96.7% chance of success." Sandecker shot Kern a withering stare. "Better make that a 99.9 percentage factor." Everyone looked at Sandecker questioningly. Then Kern said uncertainly, "I don't follow you, Admiral." "You overlook the capabilities of Pitt and Giardino," Sandecker replied with a sharp edge to his voice. "It wouldn't be the first time they bailed out a fancy intelligence agency carnival." Kern looked at him strangely, then turned to Jordan for help, but it was the president who answered. "I think what Admiral Sandecker is referring to are the several occasions Mr. Pitt has saved the government's ass. One in particular hits close to home." The president paused for effect. "You see, it was Pitt who saved my life along with that of Congresswoman Smith 4 years ago in the Gulf." "I remember," Jordan turned from the fire. "He used an old Mississippi River paddle steamer to do it." Kern refused to back down. He felt his reputation as the nation's best intelligence planner was on the line. "Trust me, Mr. President, the escape and evacuation will go as planned without help from Numa. We've taken into account every possible flaw, every contingency. Nothing but an unpredictable act of God can prevent us from pulling it off.